2006 Sunstone Symposium Arizona presents Session 11, Mormon Cinema at 5, A Health Report, a panel discussion with Eric Samuelson, Richard Dutcher, Don Godfrey, and Mark Woodward.
Hi, I would like to welcome you to what appears to be Session 11, Mormon Cinema at 5, A Health Report. I'm Eric Samuelson from BYU, head of the playwriting program there at BYU, and I'm joined here on this panel by Richard Dutcher, who is probably the filmmaker whose work began the Mormon film movement, and whose films include God's Army, Brigham City, States of Grace, and a film called Falling, which is scheduled for release sometime this fall. We also have Don Godfrey, who is a professor at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communications here at Arizona State. He's the editor of the Journal of Broadcasting and Electronic Media, has many, many publications with books and articles, and has worked also in commercial radio, public and commercial television, and corporate communications. Our third panelist is just joined us, Mark Woodward, who is professor of religious studies at ASU, specializing in Islam, religion, and culture, religion and modernity, and Islamic mysticism in Java. I've been asked to sort of begin, and I'll take about 10 minutes and give a sort of general introduction into the field, and then we'll let each of our panelists speak for about 15 minutes, and then we'll open the floor for the questions. I was asked to try and put the Mormon film movement in some kind of context and see if we can create some kind of a framework for understanding what's been accomplished so far and where we currently stand. And as I thought about that task, the first thing I thought of was a famous quote from a screenwriter, William Goldman, who said that that filmmaking is a two-part process, and the two parts are making the film and selling the film. And using a standard Hollywood model, that's actually a reasonably useful way to understand the way in which films are made. That there is a production arm or production companies who form a series of limited partnerships with marketing and distribution companies. And most marketing distribution companies we call studios, and the Big Seven also usually have some kind of in-house production company. But in essence, the Hollywood model for filmmaking is a model of limited partnerships between production companies and marketing and distribution companies. In a very real sense, the Mormon film movement has followed that model. And I think it's as significant that the first film in the movement, God's Army, also was able to immediately hook up with XL Entertainment Group, which became then basically a marketing and distribution company, and which then became the main marketing and distribution company for a number of the other more significant films within the LDS film movement. Now, obviously, I'm making this much too neat, and in fact, much of the marketing for God's Army was actually done by Richard and by Richard's company, Zion Films. But I think that there is a fairly significant sense in which XL Entertainment Group became a kind of clearinghouse, a quality clearinghouse, for the LDS films that eventually emerged. I'm going to start by showing a couple of trailers. And the first trailer I want to show is the trailer for the first God's Army film, 1999. And try and give you some sense of what a meteor across the sky this film really was. John, do you have that?
Where are you from Canada? We're going to have Kansas anymore. You're not here to do good for yourself. You've been doing that for 19 years. You come here to do good for other people.
Not true, go ahead.
You know we're missionaries, right?
Sure.
So you know what we do.
Yeah, you're kind of like nuns, but you're men.
Hi, I'm Albert Allen.
You're not going to convert a single soul. It's not about you.
Read that
book I gave you. The Lord converts them. They convert themselves. We just teach by the Spirit.
Would you mind if we left with a prayer?
Fill the
way,
find it all
around
us. Everywhere can we go?
I like to read it.
Oh, really? What would you say were the three greatest books ever written?
I think I read one of Steinbeck's back in high school. You know that one where he takes that rabbit and strangles it?
Of Mice and Men, the short one.
Someone like me teach the gospel, a missionary.
An absolute.
What would you say, the apostles and the prophets were telling the truth. They weren't telling the big lie.
Read those books I left here. A lot of things in there you should never know.
I can teach you the rules. I can teach you the discussions on what you really need to know, what's going to get you out of bed in the morning. I can't teach you that.
But,
this bus goes right through Kansas City. I can't convert you. Convert me.
Get up, you're bringing just what I want.
There we go. What we really had with God's Army then was a seriously intended fictional film intended for theatrical release, made by an LDS filmmaker, exploring with some level of complexity LDS themes and issues. And the hope always was that that would lead to further equally challenging, perhaps even more challenging, explorations of precisely those same issues. I think part of what happened is that as XL Entertainment Group got more and more involved in the film industry, XL was primarily a music distribution company founded by, of all people, Lex Diaz Avedo. Jeff Simpson bought it, and in part with the intention that it would shift then to film distribution. And really, what they did was accept and decide to distribute any LDS film with basically Hollywood level production values. They didn't really guide the decision. At the same time, I remember conversations with people from XL back in 2002, 2003, where they said that they were very proud of the fact that they had explored every major Hollywood genre or a number of major Hollywood genres in their films. They'd done a woman's melodrama with Charlie. They had done a coming-of-age story with The Other Side of Heaven. They had done a murder mystery with Brigham City. They had done a romantic comedy with Pride and Prejudice, the LDS Pride and Prejudice film. And it was very clear that to some extent that was what they wanted to do. They liked the idea of doing films that, in some respects, were structured in ways that were the followed Hollywood models, but with a Mormon twist. By the time it came around to Saints and Soldiers, you had a film where the LDS elements are very muted. Where it's pulled way back from any considerations from the church, aside from the title of the film, Saints and Soldiers, the closest thing we really get to overt Mormonism is that the main character, who's a sort of shell-shocked soldier fighting in the Battle of the Bulge in the Second World War, has a book he refers to consistently, which gives him strength and hope. But we're never told what the book is. It might be the Book of Mormon. It might be the Bible. It might be the Great Gatsby, as far as we can tell, as we say. I don't know what the negotiations were between XL and the filmmaker of that film, the director who made that film. But it may have been a two-way street. I don't really know. But there was really an interest in distancing themselves from the overt LDS elements. And as far as they were concerned, they were making a war story with Christian elements, which I thought they thought they could market a little bit better. I'm not criticizing that decision. I'm just saying that that's part of what they did. The emphasis, however, seems to have been on Hollywood-style production values. They like films that look great. Even a film like Pride and Prejudice, which has serious flaws from a narrative and character standpoint, is a great-looking film, a very stylish-looking film, and they were very proud of that fact. I want to show next the trailer for The Other Side of Heaven. Is that the next one we have? To sort of show just it's a really great-looking film, and there were a lot of resources behind this one.
Receive this letter. Joe Broberg left his world, his love, and his family.
No matter where they send me, we'll be underneath the same moon.
For a journey that took him to the center of the Pacific.
Well, you have two assignments. Learn the language, build the kingdom.
And into the heart of a people.
Welcome, Gold Book.
Dear John, it's hard to have so much faith in us when you're so far away.
Disney marketed and distributed the DVD sales, but the original theatrical release of the film was XL. It was an XL release for theatrical distribution. But as you can see from this trailer, it's a terrific looking film. It's got Hollywood style production values all the way through it, and they also really highlight the fact that Gerald Mullen, who was a line producer in some of the Steven Spielberg films, including Schindler's List, was one of the main producing people with this film. Gerald Mullen worked with John Garbett, who was a producer who'd worked with a long career at Disney. And the two of them, who were both LDS, decided to sort of jump into this LDS film world and make for them, fairly big budget film. This was budgeted, I believe, around $6 million, which is much more than the budgets for most of the other LDS films, told the story of John Groberg's mission, and it was a very it was a very big deal release. They have not yet recouped their money from the film. I think most people would agree that the returns on their investment have been a little bit disappointing. The last I saw at IMDb, it had so far grossed around $4 million, which maybe a bit more than that. But with ancillary income, DVD sales and the like, it may be close to in profit at some point soon. Nonetheless, this is the kind of thing XL was very interested in, this kind of what they called a prestige kind of project. So the XL films then all had there's no similarity of approach, really, because they were just sort of taking anything that looked good that came in the door. But there was an overall sort of XL philosophy that you see with their releases. The other entity, the competing marketing and distribution entity as well as production entity, was Hailstorm Films. And Hailstorm is different in a lot of ways. First of all, they were not only interested in marketing and distribution, but they were also interested in production. So they did both. They combined both tasks, although they have also distributed other films that they didn't make. But they started off with the film The Singles War. They've continued that with The RM, The Home Teachers, Sons of Provo. they've got an upcoming one called Church Ball that's coming out. And these films all are very, very similar in style and approach. They were all directed by Kurt Hale. They were all, for the most part, written by the same writer. And what they do actually is combine three different elements. They combine farce. In all of the Hailstorm films, people fall off ladders or trip on things or ruin a toilet and destroy somebody's Thanksgiving dinner or run across a field with deer antlers on their heads and are shot at by hunters. There's a farcical element through all the films, which is usually very badly executed, but it's always there. Second of all, they're satires in that they take a look at some... they make a particular part of Mormon culture look ridiculous, like the lives of LDS singles or the role of home teachers or what it's like to come home from a mission and have your family move without telling you where they've moved to. A common problem, as I understand it. And then they also, all of them conclude with a kind of sentimental didactic message. In the home teachers, even though the home teachers completely destroy the home and lives of one family, at the end the home teachers come to realize the importance and value of home teaching when they bury a little old lady's dog. I'm mocking these films, and I probably shouldn't. It isn't very nice of me, but the fact is they are very, very similar in look and approach, and that's slightly less true of the other films that they've distributed. They also distributed The Best 2 Years, which is right now probably the fourth best missionary movie of the LDS market, but still rather a good movie. And Baptists at Our Barbecue, neither of which they made, but they decided they wanted to compete with XL in distribution. So now I want to show the Singles Ward to give some hint at least of that sort of competing aesthetic, which is operating next to and aside from XL.
My dad just feels so much pressure to get married.
Wow. Can't imagine.
When I get married, my husband will at least have a master's degree. Yeah.
So is the spirit telling you the same thing it's telling me right now?
I hate Mormon dating. Every phone call is never enough. It's always got to be some cloak and dagger thing.
Well, welcome to the real world.
I'm not supposed to like you. I'm going on a mission, and it's kind of bad timing to get involved with someone right now.
You have gone church, Emmy Johnson. For what? Some stupid church that tells you what you can and can't do?
Brigham Young said that he wanted to build a temple for last year's millennium. It took over 40 years.
But not a little time.
It's a big dance, lots of hotties.
Brother, you're going on a mission. What do you care?
I need someone to read to you.
Dallin, I've seen your grades. You need somebody to read to you.
Look, Val, you want to get married? Try a singles work.
Other Hailstorm trademarks, rock and roll versions of LDS hymns, certain amount of meta-cinematic devices, people looking directly in the camera and addressing the camera, and of course cameos by LDS celebrities, including, I might mention, Richard Dutcher. someone who looked a great deal like Richard Dutcher. So those are the sort of two competing main streams of LDS filmmaking up to this point, sort of the XL stream and the Hailstorm stream. But there's sort of a third one as well. And the third one are films that haven't gotten distribution deals, films that where the filmmaker has ended up distributing the film by himself without actually maybe being very good at it, which seems to be the case in some instances. And this is an eccentric lot. It includes films like Day of Defense, which is basically a film of that famous pamphlet where missionaries are put on trial for being Mormon and in some mythical southern town and have to defend themselves against various ministerial strawmen. And maybe the most known of these sort of films without distribution would be the Book of Mormon movie, Gary Rogers' attempt to tell the story of First Nephi in a film version that really hasn't anything like Hollywood production values, but has a sincerity to it that some people have found very, very attractive. And others of those might include films like Handcart. There are other films that are made with very, very low budgets, and you can tell, and they're made really without distribution deals, but they nonetheless get made and get seen by some people and are certainly part of the movement. Now, since I've basically done this encapsulation of where we are with the film world, things have changed quite a bit. XL was purchased by Deseret Book and is no longer in the film distribution business. The current work in the Glory movie and the next one are both going to be distributed by a new entity called Vineyard. And Richard kind of broke from them with Zion Films and started his own distribution company to handle States of Grace and
Presumably Also Falling. Is that right?
And Possibly Also Falling. Hailstorm has meanwhile announced that they built a studio, and they just recently announced that they're going to now make films with a budget of $2 million each without LDS elements at all, which they're hoping to aim towards audiences interested in films with wholesome, positive family values. So where the current state of LDS filmmaking is very much in question, and that actually will be the focus of our panel, or at least one of the focuses of them, I assume. So without any more introduction, I'd like to turn the time then over to our first panelist, Don Godfrey. Don, could you?
I'm a novelist on the panel here. I will just go through my comments quickly and hopefully we can get and have the opportunity to talk to Richard. I'm a novice consumer, I guess. I've enjoyed some of them. I think for many of them, I've cried on cue right when I'm supposed to. I've enjoyed God's Army and Charlie and The Other Side of the Mountain. Those are the ones I think I cried on cue. Some of the others, you just cry. In terms of production values, I think we have a ways to go. And I think raising the bar on the production values, the films that have done that, at least the ones that I've seen, and I've seen more in the last 3 weeks than I've seen in the last 3 years, that would have to be Saints and Soldiers and Work in the Glory. And I don't think to tell a good LDS story that you have to hit me with Mormonism. I don't care that you can't recognize that book, what it was. I mean, for me, it was the Book of Mormon, period. No argument. I don't care. You know, I can take my colleagues to that, but I'm not going to take them to Pride and Prejudice. And I'm not going to take them to Singles Ward. They wouldn't understand it. And when I say I wouldn't take my colleagues there, my background is in television. I worked for 15 years in commercial television. So I made commercials and worked in news. I've never done anything in Hollywood. So that's why I say I'm just a novice consumer. More or less. I came to this assignment, I'll admit, a little negative. And I did it about face as I did a little homework. I was negative because, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I went to one of these Dumb and Dumber ones. And I walked away thinking, I've spent $50 for this? I should have walked out. $20 for tickets and $30 for popcorn, and it was a waste. So I quit going. I just thought if my students can produce better than that, I can see them for free. Pop my own popcorn. There were no production values. My career in television is basically behind the scenes in lighting and audio. Audio was like it was in a can. There was no... presence, no staging in terms of the quality of the sound relative to what was being staged in front of the microphone. Lighting was flat, what we would call in television. They were probably lit with one broad in the back of the studio. And it just simply lacked what I would consider production value. Writing was shallow, not bad, but the characters weren't well developed either. So I came at it with that, and like I say, I was a little negative. They were all produced for a Mormon audience. Jokes were inside jokes, which I got. I liked it. I say I had a good time going to most of them except that one. But I did the about face when I read something that Dan sent me. A manuscript on by Randy, how do you pronounce his last name? Estelle? I think he sent that to each of us on this panel. In the History of Latter-day Saint Cinema. My goodness, I hope that book gets published. And I hope it gets published outside of LDS circles. Because I think that book will teach others that we have come a long way in the history of LDS cinema. Led by some pretty good people. And we're now on a cycle, and Hollywood goes through cycles like crazy, and television goes through cycles faster than Hollywood does. We're now at the top of a pretty good cycle. And ready to jump, I think, to the next one. We have come a long way. Randy calls this the fifth wave. I think I'd have him change the title of that section of his manuscript. I'd call it the independent wave. And I think that's a huge step when people like Richard can independently produce without too much terrible negotiation. I'm assuming you have to negotiate some of the materials a little bit. Is this going to offend President Hinckley? But independent production, it's a master leap forward, and I think we are really on the verge of being able to do that, and that will leap us into the next level of independent film production. I don't think it's any accident that Spielberg does films on Jewish stories. But do you notice we all go to see him? Not because we're Jewish, but because they're darn good stories. And in that way, we learn about him and we learn about his culture. Can't we do the same thing? Of course, I realize the budget's a little different for what we are doing and what he is doing, but they're not labeled Jewish. They're just good stories with excellent production. I sinned. I went to see The Passion. I think that was an excellent story. And it wasn't labeled Catholic. It was, and Mel Gibson did a beautiful job of marketing that thing. He had the hype going, 9 months before it was ever released? But the production values were huge. And a lot of people went to see it. Not because they were Catholic, but because they loved the Savior. Okay? Cecil B. DeMille, I would guess, gave us the first bar. I mean, tell me, what does Moses look like?
Charlton Heston.
Exactly right. That's the bar. Hollywood establishes a bar. That bar is not in Richard's mind. It's not in our mind. Richard knows where that is, probably better than any of us. But that bar is a fickle thing we call an audience. And that's the first consideration, our audience. We abuse that audience, and they will go away. I think Mormon cinema today, in my casual assessment of it, is kind of where Farnsworth was, Philo T. Farnsworth, in the 1930s. If you're not familiar with Farnsworth, he's the inventor of television. Okay? And there's a wonderful story behind him. In the mid-1930s, his first telecast was a single line. Not very entertaining. His next telecast was a triangle. This would be 1927-28. Not very entertaining. Bankers thought it was kind of boring. It's going to take a mountain of money as big as Signal Hill, they said, to make this thing work. Signal Hill in San Francisco, which is where he was at the time. So he produced a dollar sign. That got them excited. But still, he had no programming. But people were coming to see these things. And it was the awe factor. This really works. That's where we are, I think, with Mormon cinema now. It's the, we got something in a theater. Ah! And then we go, ah. So Hollywood gives us a bar. Farnsworth went from there to vaudeville. Okay. Our Mormon cinema cycle is in a little vaudeville. All right. It establishes financial. Farnsworth first looked to Hollywood for his finances. Didn't find them there, although he did find some cooperation. Joan Crawford, Mary Pickford, those are historical cinema names that you might recognize. Steamboat Willie. You know who Steamboat Willie is? First Mickey Mouse. Part of Farnsworth's program lineup. But television at that particular time did not go very far because the bar that had been established in Hollywood cinema was higher than they could produce. If you can imagine looking at a television screen and seeing 60 lines, that's what Farnsworth in 1927 was producing. Now by 1934 he was producing 502,000, but those first experimental lines were, it never took him beyond the UAW factor. Picture quality was something dictated by Hollywood. Quality stories dictated again by Hollywood. Quality production dictated again by Hollywood. Today, these same qualities are dictated by Spielberg and others who are successful in producing film work for their genre. We have to step, and I think we are ready to step to that level. The same challenges is available, same challenges are out there for Mormon cinema as were for Farnsworth, and I think we have today a much more cooperative base. I don't want to quit without saying a little bit about documentary, since my background is primarily journalism and television. There is so much opportunity in documentary now. You look at the History Channel, you look at the Discovery Channel. I read again that history of the Mormon cinema, and I think, man, where are all those films? Are they anywhere, Richard? Where are all they? Could we do something in documentary with those films? I mean, those documentaries that you see on the History Channel are dirt cheap. Now they're produced as works for hire, so they don't produce a tremendously lot of cash flow. But it still helps to build the foundations of that. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this series, coming out of a television producer out of Salt Lake, just doing wonderful little documentaries on the temples, different temples. I don't think he's gone outside of Utah to do those. But they're not churchy. The gospel's not thrown at you. It's just a history that tells us a little bit. This particular one happens to be on Logan. I've seen the one on St. George. Brian Patrick, a couple of years ago, produced one on the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Now, I understand that hasn't shown in Utah. I've seen it. It's really good. Yeah, it's a little controversial, but so what? Life goes on. We make some mistakes, admit them, and move on. It was very well done. There's another documentary out of the University of Utah called Let the Women Vote. Utah was the first state in the Union to let women vote. Did you realize? Wonderful documentary produced on that. I think that one has gotten some national airtime. Some beautiful cinematography work coming out of Alberta, Canada, by members of the church, called Extreme Downtime. This video is very simple. It's not getting Hollywood distribution. It's just basically wonderful cinematography to music. I can't help but think if this cinematographer were hooked up with Richard, what kind of a quality we might have, because this guy knows nothing about, I can say it's because I know him, knows nothing about producing storylines or plot, but my goodness, the cinematography is just fantastic. So, let's include documentary into Mormon cinema somewhere. I would encourage people like Richard to concentrate on the Phoenix market. I think Phoenix is a very unique test market for Mormon cinema. Utah Mormons are a little different than Arizona Mormons. Sorry about that, folks. We are different. We also have a very friendly distribution system right here, which I'm sure Richard's talked to the Harkins family. They push independent films. Unlike any other theater in the country, Harkins sponsors and works with independent filmmakers and lets them have more screen time than you might be able to get elsewhere. So with the number of Mormons that you've got around here, also the number of non-Mormons around here, the cooperativeness of somebody like Harkins, you've really got an opportunity. I don't know what's happening with the BYU channel, but I think there's opportunity there. I'm bored with talking heads. I'm sorry. I love the gospel, but I don't need to have I don't need 24/7 talking head. And I've never gone to BYU, and I still have a testimony, so I don't need to see old BYU baseball games or football games. I want to see something a little different. Maybe our filmmakers could approach them, and BYU could put a trailer on the end of them saying, buy this product for $19.95, and I might do that. Sell DVDs, something like that. If sacrifice is necessary in terms of cinematography and what we must do, then we cannot, I say we, I'm not part of the we, then the filmmakers cannot sacrifice quality because they will lose the audience. I don't know what can be sacrificed in terms of trying to make the budget meet expectations, because I fully realize the complexity of what it takes to put these things together. Maybe the film has to be shorter. But when I go to a film that says the Book of Mormon and it looks like roadshow costumes, that turns me off. I want to see Mel Gibson playing Nephi. Now think about that for a minute. Would that be good? I think we are making tremendous progress, and I think we owe a tremendous debt to people like Richard and some of the other people that were mentioned here as we introduced our panel. Like I said, I came in here a little bit negative. I did my homework, and I'm about faced. I'm pleased with the work and the direction that these fellows are taking us, and I think it won't be long before we will see the qualities of the kinds of things that DeMille and Spielberg and Gibson can put out.
Well, again, I'd like to thank Dan and Doe very much. In one way or another, I've been involved with showing movies since I was in graduate school. I supported myself my first year in graduate school showing 16-millimeter prints of old movies like the Marx Brothers in college auditoriums. Now, that sort of dates me, because that tells you that that was in the days before such things as DVDs. Nobody could get away with this today. And in recent years, I've taught a course here at ASU called Religion and Popular Culture, which is exclusively about exploring the stated or, more interestingly, unstated religious and mythological themes in, basically blockbuster Hollywood-type movies. Now, until very recently, I did not know that there was such a thing as Mormon cinema, which, again, is sort of like confessing my ignorance of, what we're doing today. And I've watched some over the last few weeks. I watched Army of God, and I watched another one. It's something about space. Plan 10 from Outer Space, which were very, very different sort of movies. I mean, Richard's, you know, Army of God was a really serious film, and Plan 10 from Outer Space was one of the most ridiculous things that I've ever seen in my life, although it really was funny. I want to draw a distinction here, though, when we're talking about how audiences look at film and what film does in popular culture. There's some films, like The Passion of the Christ, that hit you over the head. Right? You know when you walk in there that this is a religious film. Sort of in the same way that, at least when I was a kid during Holy Week, you didn't have a whole lot of choice about what you watched on television, because it was the robe or the shoes of the fisherman or, you know, all that they had on TV, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s was Jesus. Well, so that's one kind of religious movie. There's another kind of film that builds on religious or mythological themes in a much more subtle way, and it may well be the case that you're watching a film that's, you know, repeating or building on religious or mythological archetypes, and you may not even be aware of it. There's one of those right now that is a real big Hollywood hit, which is the film version of C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Now, a lot of people, I'm sure that there are a lot of people who will watch that film who are completely unaware of the fact that this is a high church Anglican Christian allegory. You don't necessarily, given my background in religious studies and anthropology, it would be hard for me to miss that fact, but I'm sure that particularly a lot of young people who go to see that film will not be aware of it, right? One of the examples that I use with my students, I don't know how many of you have seen this film, the Julia Roberts film, Pretty Women. How many folks have seen that? Okay, well, that's a retelling of what story? Cinderella. There's even a giveaway line in the middle of the film, right? This is it's just one of these women says to Julie Roberts, "Who do you think you are, Cinderella?" Now, I've noticed that a lot of my students don't pick up on this right away, and what I have to do in these films is really go through, you know, I do a lot of stop and explain and stop and explain and stop and explain. I have to watch the films about 25 times before I use them in class because I basically have to memorize the dialogue, and I have to research it sometimes to figure out, you know, what's going on here. Like if I was going to use The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you know, I really would go back to C.S. Lewis's text, and then I would want to try and go back to the biblical text. Now, in some sense, it's this category of film that I think are most interesting. Some of the others, when it comes to the LDS films, are currently done in such a way that you either have to be a member of the church, or you have to be a non-member of the church who knows a fair amount about it and, you know, basically has a sympathetic perspective to really be able to pick up on what's going on. And particularly sometimes to be picking up on some of the humor, like seagulls, right? When a seagull appears in an LDS film, everybody who's Mormon knows that story, right? 95% of people who are not members of the church would think, what is this seagull doing in here? Or honeybees? Or beehives? You know, these are things that people who are Mormons, these are symbols that people who are Mormons pick up on right away that non-Mormons just don't get and can't get. Now, I think for the development of a real, this is a personal opinion based on, you know, basically looking at film as mythology, that to find a really successful genre of LDS films that is going to be, as you said, I don't care what the production values are here. They can be Spielberg production values. But people are going to have to come up with films that are subtle enough that the story itself is going to have an appeal to a general audience. This is not an easy trick to do. I don't know whether you agree with me on this or not. They can be successful in kind of a limited way. I think Army of God has been successful in, it's a successful project. It's certainly the type of film that's well enough. But I think one of the tricks is how to develop a film which still is true to this theological tradition and yet is broad enough that people who are not only non-members of the church, but people who know absolutely nothing about it are going to find it appealing. And I know one that's always found kind of strange. And in the manuscript that Dan sent, and I've heard this rumor around here before, one that really succeeded in this way, it wasn't a film, it was a television series that was really rather popular in the 1970s, that I and a whole bunch of my friends, we used to every week, we only knew one person with cable TV, and you could only, in Urbana, Illinois, you could only get it on cable TV. And that was pretty new, and as graduate students, we couldn't afford it. So every week, we'd go over to Linda's house and order pizza and watch this ridiculous science fiction show called Battlestar Galactica. How many people remember Battlestar Galactica? And I started hearing this rumor once I moved to Arizona that this was a Mormon science fiction show. I was absolutely clueless. I didn't think it was a Mormon science fiction show. I thought it was a science fiction show with lots of spaceships blowing up and aliens and all sorts of other cool and groovy stuff. But apparently people who are LDS, I'm just reporting what people have told me, will look at it and they'll see all sorts of inside LDS references or jokes or whatever, like, a council of elders. And it's been years and years and years since I've seen it. I went to the video stores last week and I couldn't find any copies of it. And some of the kids who work in these places sort of looked at me like I was from Mars. But that's an example of an entirely different genre of things. That I would put sort of in the same category as The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That's a rather facile comparison in terms of quality, but in terms of, the type of analysis I'm pursuing, it seems to fit, is that if you know, you know. And if you know, you get the message. And if you don't know, hey, it's a good story. Okay? And I think, this is approaching the issue, basically from the perspective of, of religious studies or the study of mythology, that sort of thing. But I think that it's an element that, is at least potentially informative of, how this really, really quite remarkable young tradition is going to develop.
Thank you, Mark. Now, time for Richard Dutcher. Richard?
First, Eric, can you pause that a second?
Hi, it's great to be here and talk with you today.
There's so much to talk about with LDS cinema. There's really not time to go into anything. I don't want to go off on any particular tangents because I especially want you all to have the opportunity to ask questions that you want answered. I have such deep concerns for LDS cinema. I have such a passion for it. I had such a vision for it. And the last 5 years have been a strange ride. I've been more depressed than I've ever been in my life. I've been more exhilarated than I've ever been in my life. And I do still have a certain vision for, no longer for LDS cinema. I really no longer have a vision for LDS cinema because I realize that I don't have any control over it. But I do have a vision for the kind of films that I want to make, and if those films are grouped in with what people consider Mormon cinema, then that's fine with me. But I definitely have to start. I, as a filmmaker, have to start making that distinction in my own mind. So why don't we just go ahead and open it up for questions?
Okay.
Oh, how about a great trailer? You want to see a great trailer? Let's watch one.
Are like normal, right?
Yeah. How many days left, Lozano?
7 days, 9 hours, and 48 minutes.
Came here to teach, play basketball.
Missionaries not engaged in gang warfare. I was a good story. Gang kid, gets baptized, goes on a mission even. I think I was a better convert than a missionary, you know?
Hey, man, what's up? I thought that was you out there.
You're looking good. I woke up once. Hospital, you were there. We were praying.
Are y'all like friends?
Yeah, we're friends.
Like, I ain't never have no Mexican for no friend, no white boy for no friend.
What is wrong with you? They almost killed you, and all you want to do is sit and read the Bible.
You been watching, touching Jesus, freak. Come on, man, you're not gonna pop some preacher, man.
I just don't think I turned into much of a missionary.
You've made a difference.
I'm interested that nobody mentioned Napoleon Dynamite. Is that not explicitly a Mormon enough to be considered part of the Mormon film?
And nobody
canon?
Mentioned Brigham City either, which That's irritates true. Me.
And as far as documentaries go, the New York Doll was an excellent documentary with a Mormon theme, and I think it was made, I'm pretty sure it was made by a Mormon filmmaker, too.
You're talking about New York Doll?
New York Doll.
Yeah, Greg Quietly directed that film, and he's an LDS filmmaker. It's a wonderful, wonderful documentary. I was glad that Don mentioned Doc, because it's a superb film. As for Napoleon Dynamite, I consider it a Mormon film. I think it's a tremendously interesting Mormon film. It isn't overtly Mormon, really at all. But what it is I think a film that talks about Mormon culture as insular, as isolated, and is looking at for example African American culture and going, that is so cool. Why can't we be more like that? And eventually becoming it. I think it's a wonderful film. Of course, throughout all the discussion of LDS film, the one thing every LDS filmmaker I've ever talked to has said is, why can't we have the crossover hit? Why can't we have the one big crossover hit? And now we have, and a lot of the filmmakers are looking at it going, I don't get it. But I think I do. I think the target audience for that is anybody that felt weird and picked on in high school, which is a rather large demographic, I think.
I have several questions. Other than The Other Side of Heaven, which was distributed by Walt Disney, are there any other Mormon films that were distributed by a Walt Disney-type company? Or are they all independently distributed here in Utah, or in Utah primarily by Zion Films?
Other Side of Heaven was distributed by XL Entertainment Group. The DVD sales were distributed by Disney, but that came later after the film had already had theatrical release through XL. As far as other distribution, the only other one is Napoleon Dynamite, which was...
My second question is, since the IFC channel, Independent Film Channel, puts stuff on there that I wonder sometimes how they ever get it on there, what kind of entrance have you made with IFC?
There's a real divide. Is this working? There's a real divide in the... a movie like Napoleon Dynamite or Saints and Soldiers and something, because it does step away from any overt representation of Mormonism or religion in general, can have some success there. What I found is that anything that, I'm very active in the independent film community. Not talking about the LDS film community, but the independent film community, but it's kind of like I'm... for instance, when I first made God's Army and tried to get, first of all, Sundance to show it, I thought, they promote themselves as very interested in giving voice to, independent filmmakers who don't have a voice or cultures and all this. But what I found was they were interested in, they only want certain voices to be heard. They don't really want other voices to be heard. And anything that, what I have found, and I'm not, this is not reactionary, this is what I have really found to be true, is anything that treats religion or religious characters with respect or with any degree of reverence is really not welcome as part of the independent film conversation. This film, States of Grace, I became very cynical about festivals and independent film groups, and I wasn't even going to submit States of Grace to a festival, but the director of the Los Angeles Film Festival saw the film and loved it, just absolutely raved about it. And he, please submit it. And so I thought, wow, well, maybe we finally broken through. So I submitted the film to that festival, and the director gave it to his selection committee of six people. And then he called me back about 3 weeks later and said, I'm so sorry, all six rejected the film. We're not going to be showing it. And I said, why? Because he had enjoyed it so much. And thought it was such an he thought it was such an excellent film. And he said the response that came back from the judging committee was that it was, quote, too Jesus-y. And and so I was angry for about a minute because it confirmed everything that I believed. But it's that way over and over again. But I want to address something that I strongly disagree. First of all, I do not believe that LDS cinema should be this or it should be that. People will argue till they're blue in the face that LDS cinema should be crossover, that it there shouldn't be any overt Mormonism in it. And other people will say no, it should be should be filled with Mormonism. And there's no either or. This film can be this way. This film can be this way. The sad thing will be if there's no more of either of one of these kind of films. I think both of these things need to exist. My fear is that one particular kind of film, the film with overt Mormonism in it, is going to disappear. You know, by my conversations with the other LDS filmmakers and with the distributors, this is becoming very apparent to me that this is becoming the unpopular thing in the LDS cinema movement now, is to actually explore Mormonism. There's not a lot of interest in that.
I have one more question.
I think it's going to disappear because the audience is so small. And I don't think unless we raise, until the bar is raised, where the audience can appreciate more that which is being done, they will tire of it. It's a cycle. Hollywood and television are full of cycles. I mean, Napoleon Dynamite, the reason I didn't bring it up was, oh, man, I've had enough Dumber and Dumb. I mean, but you can't, I wish I had the royalties on it in my pocket. I feel the same thing with The Hope and the Glory. I'm the historian. I do not like my history messed up with Hollywood. But it's a good piece. And it teaches some history. So, yeah, it is going to disappear unless we support it, and unless I would agree with Richard that we have to have both. But I don't want to have it thrown at me all the time. And why don't we, I have a question, why don't we establish our own film festival? There is an LDS film festival. Why would it have, let's broaden that out a little bit. Why can't it be a film festival with, I don't know, for films produced with Christian values? Get a little more. I mean, there are hundreds of cinema students out there learning with very little venue. Nowhere to go. I mean, you think your distribution is limited. There's a zero.
Back in the late 1990s, when I was so frustrated and I wanted to do something with LDS cinema, some of the things that irritated me beyond my capacity to endure were, one, stereotype or negative, ignorant portrayals of Mormons in film and on television. Every time I'd watch, you know, some Mormon would, it was, although labeled a Mormon, these characters were completely unrecognizable as Mormons, and yet they were still mocked as Mormons. So that was one thing. The other thing was the LDS filmmakers who were working in the business refused to do overtly LDS subject matter or characters. They would even take a story that came out of Mormonism, but by the time it hit the screen, the bishop was no longer a bishop. He was now just a minister. The community was no longer Mormon. It was just, you know, everyday community. There was no, the particular doctrines were no longer LDS. They were just generalized Christian things, and those irritated me. What I see now is, because most LDS filmmakers are not so much interested in the culture or even in the religion all that much, it seems to me that they're interested in the market. Everything is reverting back to the way that it was in 1996. Except now, the negative stereotypes that are coming out about Mormons are now made by Mormons, such as Hailstorm Entertainment. So, which I find as offensive as I would, you know, if I were black, seeing somebody throw a minstrel show, black people throw their own minstrel show, that's what I think is the level of most of Hailstorm Entertainment films. The other thing I see is our LDS filmmakers who are shying away from the religion, who are doing exactly what it was before, because they thought that the market would, that the films would succeed in the market if they were overtly Mormon. They started to do that. Once the film started to struggle, they started to think, oh, well, maybe, ooh, Saints and Soldiers or Napoleon Dynamite, let's start taking everything out again. So we're going to end up in exactly the same place we are, except for what I hope will be a few independent filmmakers who will continue to explore Mormonism and portray Mormon characters in an interesting and intelligent way.
Last question. What is your opinion of the non-Mormon films that feature Mormon missionaries primarily, such as Latter Days and Orgasmo, which essentially take a Mormon missionary couple, follow them through on a very Mormon positive tone, and then suddenly turn into gay lesbian type movies?
Yes, indeed.
Well, I really personally, I don't want to become a critic of other people's movies. I want to make my own. I definitely comment on, you know, general movement that I see happening. But I wrote a scathing critique of The Singles Ward, which my evil brother appeared in. in a foolish, you know, in a moment of foolishness, and it really came back to bite me, you know, because the community wasn't big enough to, you know, separate filmmaker from film, and so I actually bruised some feelings, and so right now I really avoid commenting on other people's films unless I really, really hate them. Singles word.
I just wish you'd be a little more forthright, Richard, and say what you really mean. I have seen Latter Days, I do know that the filmmaker is a gay Mormon who is essentially telling his own story in that film, and I think it's quite an honest and interesting film. Orgasmo, I have not seen and wouldn't really comment on, but at least Latter Days really ought to be part of the conversation when we talk about an LDS filmmaker.
I have a question, Richard. I work in interreligious dialogue as one of my jobs. And when I first saw your God's Army, I literally came from the movie thinking, this is it. This is it. This will be an influence on my Muslim friends, on my Catholic friends, who need to tell their stories, their indigenous stories. And I thought you were starting a new genre that I was going to make hay on in my business. Not money, but literally create a dialogue. Have you had a dialogue go on between other filmmakers that have convictions like yours in their own faith community saying, you've hit it, we want to do something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's some of the best feedback. What feels like the best feedback now is when I get recently a young Christian scientist, when I was speaking in another state, came up and talked about how much, you know, my films had inspired him to, you know, try to do the same thing within his religious community. And I thought that was exciting to me. That was enormously exciting. And I hope that a lot of that would happen. So, yeah, that's wonderful. And I also, but what disappoints me is what I was an idealist. When God's Army came out, I thought, okay, we're going to, now, you know, finally I was out there, you know, preaching like an evangelist, saying, you know, now, you know, the door's open. We can tell our own, we can reach in, we can tell all these stories that have been building up for so long. We can talk about Mormon history, Mormon doctrine, the problem, our struggles with faith. We can talk about all these things that we want to express. This Mormonism can finally have an expression in film. And that's why during almost all of 2002 and 2003 I was depressed as hell, because I just was watching my ideals, my vision, my naivete was dying, because I just saw what was inevitable, that it wasn't going to be. I really thought, because I know the history of film, and there are very few spiritual or filmmakers who deal seriously with spirituality in film. I mean, in the 100-some-odd years of film, there's maybe a half a dozen filmmakers, and, you know, which means maybe 30, 35 films that really try to reach into the core of human spirituality from, you know, from whatever tradition. And I actually thought, wow, here we are, Mormon, you know, as the Mormon community can now be the community that we can grab hold of this ball and we can run with it. And then within 10 years, whenever people think about spirituality in cinema, they're going to think about the Mormon community, what the Mormon community is doing. And the Mormon community can influence other communities to do something similar. And then I just watched as the minstrel show started, and I watched as the audiences... and you see, when we talk about people... I always hate to hear people say, go out and support this film. You know, we got to support this film. We should be making films that people don't have to support. They just want to go see them, so they go see them. The frustrating thing, the frustrating position we're at now at this part of the cycle, is that the filmmakers have violated the trust of the audience. The audience doesn't want to go out anymore because the audience has been burned, not once, not twice, not three times. They've been more than that. So now, I even had trouble with this film. I ran into Robert Kirby, who's a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, and he just loved Brigham City, and he really liked God's Army. And States of Grace had come and kind of slipped away, and it was gone. I ran into him, and I said, have you seen this? And he goes, no, I decided I wasn't going to see it. And I said, why? You know, because you really liked God's Army. You loved Brigham City.
why didn't you go see this film? And he goes, yeah, I thought, you know, just in my brain said, oh, Mormon movie, it's not going to be any good, don't go see it. Even though he had seen my previous films. It was very instructive for me to realize that the audience doesn't look at a film and go, oh, hey, that's a Richard Dutcher film. You know, hope, you know, they look at it and they just go, oh, Mormon movie. And the opinion of the public perception of Mormon films after in the past little while has sunk to a real low. And that's disturbing to me because now...
Some do. Yeah, I'm going to have to disagree with you on that, Richard.
Maybe not enough, but some do look at the director.
Oh, thanks.
In fact, this leads me to my question, if you don't mind. And this goes, actually, I was curious to what Mark Woodward had to say about this. Here's another director. Here's a hipster playwright who goes into film, Neil LaBute. And he's more of an abrasive director. He did Your Friends and Neighbors. He did In the Company of Men. He doesn't have any sort of overt Mormon, you know, sort of, you know, material. It's more of just humans, maybe the dark side of human nature. I was curious what your assessment was of Neil LaBute and his work. Because, sometimes I will go see a film because I know somebody's done it. You know, Richard Dutcher, I recognize your films. You know what I mean? Neil LaBute, I recognize his name. And I was interested in what... Have you seen these films?
No, I haven't seen those. But I do want to add one thing. Now that I'm aware of the existence of, you know, this sort of distinctive genre of Mormon film, the next time I teach that course, I'm going to, you know, in part because of the composition of our student body, and in part just because they fit so well with the theme of the course, which is how religion has influenced cinema, I'm going to be certain to include one, and I think. I've heard some pretty convincing arguments here that it's not going to be won by hailstorm.
Oh, well, actually, let me go back to Randy's comment just really quickly. Another really gratifying thing is occasionally I'll just learn that some college somewhere, three or four times in the past year, I've learned that the college courses teaching religion and film or world religions will be watching God's Army or Brigham City, and that thrills me too. To think, it's like, wow, you know, it's like, you know, regardless of whatever it does at the box office, to know that it's entering the cultural conversation in some form, and hopefully having a positive influence.
Could we get you to come down here and talk about it when we do it?
When you show Brigham City in your class?
Or
when you show a double feature of States of Grace and Brigham City? I'll absolutely come down.
Couple things. First of all, Neil LaBute absolutely should be part of the conversation. He has done one overtly Mormon piece, which is Bash, which is a play of his that played in New York and then was turned into a televised version of the play was done on Showtime. So that is an overtly LDS piece by Neil LaBute, but certainly LDS values are infused throughout his work, and he is a graduate of BYU. Don's question was, what about the BYU channel? Can anything be done there? And I can answer that question from my own personal experience with one word, and that one word is correlation. Because as long as the BYU channel, whatever we show on the BYU channel, has to pass church correlation, and that really limits in really substantial ways what things can be shown there. For some reason, BYU football games pass correlation. I'm not quite sure why. You may notice they only show BYU football games that BYU won.
I'm sorry I arrived late, but is the commercial success of this important? And if so, is there perhaps a way that marketing DVDs and maybe doing something with Deseret Books is kind of moving out there a little bit? If there can generate enough cash flow to provide the seed capital and interest till you get
cash
on the next
sign.
I'm sorry?
Never mind. No, absolutely. It's absolutely crucial. And something that we didn't have time to go into is that that's one of the reasons that we're going to be in a real lull over the next year. I mean, we're going to see some things trickling in. But what's happened is over all these 20-some-odd films that Eric's mentioned, there have only been two, possibly three of those films that were financially profitable to the investors. Most of those films lost almost all the money that was put into them. What that means is that there's hundreds of investors out there who stepped into LDS Cinema, and I can pretty much tell you that any Latter-day Saint who that people know have a little bit of money has been approached to invest in an LDS film, probably. And those people, having failed, don't want to jump into that again. It's becoming increasingly difficult. It took me 3 years to get the money together for States of Grace because Brigham City didn't perform well financially. And when you put that kind of, that's going to cause a real, real damp. And one of the reasons that we got such a rush was everybody heard about the success of God's Army and they were going, oh, 2.6 million and, you can do them for next to nothing. And there was such a rush in there because they thought they could make so much money. And now, of course, all of that is drying up and the reality is starting to sink in. A lot of the companies are spinning this, they're spinning these success stories, which really are not success stories. They're probably success stories for the distribution company because the distribution company is taking a little bit off of every dollar that comes in before they send it back to the investors. But there are very few success stories for the investors. So that's going to be that combined with the lack of trust from the audience is really, really going to hurt us over the next few years. And I predict and prophesy a lull, and hopefully something will come back to resurrect it.
Back in 1971 at BYU, I was there, and I was on the Faculty of Communications at the time. Lauren F. Wheelwright was the dean of the College of Fine Arts and Communications and launched what he thought would be an ongoing, I'm not sure it's ongoing, I don't think it is, it was the Mormon Festival of Arts. And the idea was to gather together artists. In the broadest sense of the term, this would be writers and people in the performing arts and the plastic arts and I guess the cinematic arts. But the issue that came up, and I just make this as an observation, was what was it that constituted Mormon art? And it was a question, I suppose, that you dealt with what constitutes Mormon film or cinema. Is it a film about Mormons? Is it a film by Mormons? Is it a film about characters who are motivated by Mormon ideology or concepts of spirituality? I mean, would Angels in America be considered Mormon because there are Mormons in it? There's Saints and Soldiers. Very subtly, there was a Mormon in it. Is that Mormon? Does it have to be? At what level of exposure does the Mormon culture have to have in the film in order for it to be categorized as that? And I suppose you've been over that maybe. Earlier, but it was a question that the people who were putting together this festival struggled with because they had to have a standard of inclusion or exclusion as to participants in it, and I just wondered whether that has ever been resolved. I don't think it was in our time. I don't think maybe it can't be. But the question that I guess I have after making that reminiscence is that There is a problem in making spiritual films because it seems like people like shallow films. Jurassic Park is kind of interesting, and it's King Kong is more of a technical tour de force, but it's kind of shallow. And people like them, and those often become blockbusters if they have great stars that look good. And they're not really drawn to films that deal, they usually have French English subtitles because American films are kind of shallow. And will you ever surmount that marketing problem that the populace in general is interested more in exteriorities than interiorities?
Just that I was voicing these thoughts a few times over the past couple days because my concern is that I feel like my films are getting better and they're making less money as they go along. So that's my fear, is that the better the movie is, the fewer people are going to go see it, and that I need to make a really moronic movie and maybe that'll revive my career.
write a book and see how
But yeah, that's a concern, and it's tricky. The concept that we have, I mean, most the Latter-day Saint community, most people only see film as entertainment, and it needs to be wholesome entertainment to start with. But the concept of film or cinema as art is so incredibly foreign to most Latter-day Saints that it's really hard to educate them that film can be, that film is the most powerful art form that's yet been devised, and that, you know, we have such an opportunity to do something with it. That's the frustration that I feel. But you know, it's the same in the mainstream, because, like you said, you know, Jurassic Park will make millions and hundreds of millions of dollars. And Munich, Steven Spielberg's most recent film, I saw it. It was in one theater in Provo. And, I mean, in all of Utah County, I saw it last week on a Friday night, and the theater wasn't even full, you know. Whereas people are, you know, standing in line to see some moronic Hollywood film. I think you just have to understand that that's the way it is, and that's probably why Spielberg does a Minority Report, and then he does, you know, Munich, or he'll do this, and then he'll do that. It's probably a very, very smart way of doing it.
Unfortunately, we're nearly out of time. We have time perhaps for one question. We have maybe about 1 minute left.
I'll skip part of what I was going to say, but I was really taken with Saints and Soldiers. Actually, in teaching film for Real Salado, there used to be a lot more demand that we teach cinema in the graduate level. It's still prevalent at ASU, I know, but junior college, they've kind of faded away from that. And we could always promote God's Army and some of these other classics. But it really bothered me in Saints and Soldiers that build up to the end, and they can't even mention that was the Book of Mormon. It just really got under my skin that we have to be drawing those lines, and you've alluded to it, but could any of you comment a little more on that? And one other thing, did it do well in the marketplace at all? I have no idea how successful it was. Thank you.
Saints and Soldiers did not do well in the market, no, despite winning just about every minor film festival that it entered. As far as the decision to minimize the Mormon-ness of the characters. My understanding is that Ryan Little's original screenplay for that was more overtly Mormon, and that XL persuaded him to filter out those elements. In the hopes that it would be a more successful film outside the LDS market with a more Christian kind of market. But I think it damaged the film substantially.
And there's a term in the Jewish community, self-hating Jew. Have you heard that term before? Where, you know, and we have self-hating Mormons, and that's basically that's something that I wonder when a filmmaker does that, when he makes a film about his own people, about his own culture, about a Mormon experience, and it seems to me, and I'm not saying this specifically because I don't know, but it sure seems to me that it happens enough that we have a problem with self-hating Mormons. You know, they don't be outed as Mormons. You know, they may testify to it on Sunday, but then when it comes to putting it out there and actually claiming this belief or claiming this identity, they don't want to do it. And I'm with you. I like Saints and Soldiers too, but that irritated me, and it also irritated me in something like Other Side of Heaven, which did come out and say, okay, this guy, I mean, it's very clear that the guy was a Mormon missionary, but when it came time to do a blessing, a healing ordinance on someone, you know, they back away. As I they turn something that maybe being afraid that this would be weird to an audience, they turn it into something even more weird, you know, that makes no sense. So I'm all for, I mean, it's great for people to make movies like Napoleon Dynamite or whatever that are general films. Not all films need to be these personal religious expressions, but some do. You know, this community needs it desperately. This culture needs it desperately, and that's why it irritates me so much when those who have the opportunity, the camera's there, the actors are there, everybody's on the set, and instead of, you know, and then at the last minute say, let's turn him into a Methodist. That really bugs me, and I call that the self-hating Mormon filmmaker.
Okay, one last comment, Mark.
Just one, since I'm handing the mic over. We've come an awful long ways.
I think that that's a real problem, and it bothers me, too, to see people sort of shy away from their own religious heritage, and I don't want to defend people who do that, but it's a fact that in terms of the market, and I really hate to close on this note, and we all know that there's still a great deal of prejudice against the Mormon community in this country. Being the parent of a kid in high school, I hear that kind of stuff, all the time. And, I've tried to make sure that my own children don't think in that way, but an awful lot of their friends do.
But isn't film the perfect way to break down some of those barriers and prejudices and correct some of the ignorance that's out there about our community?
And now we really are finished. Thank you so much to our panelists, and thank you all for coming.